I want now to look briefly at Jefferson's experience in Williamsburg as a college student. Because while Williamsburg was hardly a huge city, it was the capital of Virginia. And Thomas Jefferson soaked up its life. He attends parties and dances, races and fox hunts, and of course sits in at the sessions of the House of Burgesses and the General Court. While in Williamsburg, Small and Wythe introduce him to the colonial governor, Francis Fauquier, and together they form what he calls a parti quare, a foursome. It's a remarkable assemblage. These three older and sophisticated men, Governor Fauquier himself was a member of the Royal Society. He was over 60 years old. They're fraternizing with the 16-year-old. From them he claims to hear, and I quote, "more good sense, more rational and philosophical conversation than in all my life besides." Well, this is an important part of Jefferson's experience. This is where Jefferson shines, in small communities of discourse, where enlightenment conversations and refined discussions can show off his incredible intellect and charm. But they're more than that. They're also important symbols for Jefferson, symbols of father figures and role models. "I had the good fortune to become acquainted," he writes, "very early with some characters of very high standing, and to feel the incessant wish that I could even become what they were. Under temptations and difficulties, I could ask myself, what would Dr. Small, Mr. Wythe, do in this situation? I am certain that this mode of deciding my conduct tended more to its correction than any reasoning powers I possessed." Okay. Jefferson, though, was a normal college student. He didn't only live with the bon ton of Williamsburg. He also fraternized with his friends. And Jefferson's closest friends at William and Mary were all old classmates from Maori school, fellows like John Page, Dabney Carr, and Jack Walker. Together they formed something called the Flat Hat Club, a juvenile association devoted to the usual hijinks one associates with college students. They drink, they dance, they gamble, they gossip about women. But Jefferson's unique among them because, according to Page, he was the only one who, and I quote, "could tear himself away from his dearest friends to fly to his studies." Well, finally, I want to look at the way a remarkable contrast in Jefferson, the way he deals with women, because he's utterly with himself and confident among his male compatriots, even with these older distinguished gentlemen. But around girls, he is shy and bashful. There's a wonderful story about his romance with Rebecca Burwell. She's a 16-year-old sister of one of his classmates that he meets in 1762 in Williamsburg. He calls it Devilsburg because it's the Sin City. He is absolutely mortified. I mean, he's enchanted with her, and he can't speak to her. He's absolutely afraid for a full year. Nonetheless, while he still hasn't spoken to her, she's mentioned over 9 times in letters. Finally, he works up the courage to ask her for a silhouette that he can put in his watch fob. He could put in his watch, excuse me. Once he gets it, in short order, it becomes drenched and torn, and he's afraid to ask for another. He keeps begging his friend Page, "please treat for me. Go and play Cyrano de Bergerac to her for me." Page refuses. Finally, he meets up with her in Williamsburg on October 7th, 1763, and he writes the following remarkable letter to John Page. "In the most melancholy fit that ever any poor soul was, I sit down to write to you. Last night, as merry as agreeable company and dancing with Belinda," that's his nickname for Rebecca Burwell, Belinda, beautiful by day, Belinda, "in the Apollo room could make me, I never could have thought that the succeeding sun would have seen me so wretched as now I am. I was prepared to say a great deal. I had so dressed up, in my own mind, such thoughts as occurred to me in as moving a language as I know how, and I expected to have performed in a tolerably creditable manner. But good God! When I had an opportunity of venting them, a few broken sentences, uttered in great disorder, and interrupted with pauses of uncommon length, were the two visible marks of my strange confusion." Jefferson was reduced to the traditional young man's a-hummin-a-hummin-a-hummin-a-hey. Okay. Jefferson then tries to treat with her, tries to offer his love, beg her to, obliquely in his own shy way, offer an engagement to her if she'll wait for him to return from his grand tour. She's absolutely silent on this, undoubtedly because it's an incredible suggestion. He takes that silence quite optimistically as assent. His friend John Page urges him, "you've got to pursue her. You can't let her walk away from that. You've got to nail this down." But Jefferson is unwilling to speak to her again, in part because he's afraid of what will obviously be the case. He's going to learn that she's not willing to agree to this. And the next spring, he in fact learns that she's engaged to be married. Well, what does this tell us about Jefferson? It tells us that Jefferson is a normal young man. But what we also see is connected to this normal young man with his normal shyness and insecurities is a remarkable intellect, a precocious mind, one that's negotiating between, on the one hand, a growing and soaring intellect, on the other, a very shy and quiet emotional core. What we're going to do in our subsequent lectures is trace this contrast between inner core and external appearance, the appearance of a benign mind, through his experiences, not only as a revolutionary American, but then abroad, as his thinking matures and becomes more and more radical, and then finally see how this impacts his presidency, his retirement, and what sense we make of it in his overall career. What I hope you've come away with from this first lecture is the sense that Jefferson's early childhood was in many ways, although hard to get at, important in forming the emotional and psychological core of his subsequent development.